Hello, and welcome to another Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast. Today we're going to talk about the latest issue of Ancient Warfare Magazine, issue 13.2, which deals with geography and warfare in the ancient world. And we've got some questions that have been submitted to us by our patrons and on our Facebook page and social media. And one question that came up from several people deals with maps in the ancient world, which is a very relevant question and one that I happen to know is not dealt with in the issue. So let's talk maps. Do we know what maps were like in the ancient world? Were they used by ancient generals? Were they state secrets? Were there specialized survey mapping units and navies? There's quite a bit of stuff to talk about, and some things we're going to have to say don't know, and some things we probably can say something about. Who wants to start with that one?
Well, I think we can start by saying they did have maps, but they're not maps as we know them. That the ancient world maps were very much itineraries, that they had locations, perhaps geographical features, but very much in a linear fashion, like the Peutinger table and a couple of other fragments of maps that survive. That tell you there's a city, there's a road, there's a river, there's a city, there might be 5 days between, and that those maps are often miss out things that you might expect them to have because we think of that location as being an important one, but it would be between the two locations on the ancient map, but it's not there because it's not part of that itinerary, I suppose. And we have the ancient periply, I'm not sure what the plural of periplus is. And they, of course, are the sailings around, which we've got for Africa, the Erythraean Sea, the Black Sea, and a couple of others. And they are the same. They are, you sail for this many days, you come to a port, you sail for this many days, you come to a river, you can trade here. We know that there are people who are sent out to do these surveying. Some of them, of course, have been plagued with, no, that person never existed, like Pythias and a couple of others. But then we know that those others were sent. And if Lindsay was here, he would tell us all about Germanicus. So those missions are sort of sponsored. We also know that people provided maps to people like Pompey of the local area. So I suppose they must have been secretive. But then Augustus posted a map of the Roman Empire. So they can't be that secretive.
And Alexander the Great had his own specialist corps of surveyors known as the Bima Tisti, who would follow his army around as he went into Asia and his various travels, and they would measure all of the distances as they progressed. So there was, at least with his army, a group of people who specialized in doing these measurements.
Yeah, I think there's an expectation in mapping. You know, when you see people put online the real map of the world, not the shrunken version to make Europe bigger and Africa smaller, that when you see the real dimensions of the world, people go, what's that? That's not the map I'm used to seeing. And the funny thing, of course, about that is the continuity of that idea. When you go back and you look at the early exploration maps of America in the 16th and 17th centuries, when you look at the early discovery maps of Australia and New Zealand, for instance, they're not the maps we expect either. They're a bit wonky. They're missing things out. They haven't realized that an isthmus is an island or an island is an isthmus. And I think the ancient world maps, again, what they wanted from a map was not this geographical drone-like satellite photo. They wanted how far between drinking spots. That's it. You know, so I think that the maps of the ancient world gave the material that they wanted. They didn't necessarily, when we say measure distances, it's not, you know, the heights of mountains, it's just 4 days march, you know, this many leagues, this many, you know, that sort of stuff.
It is perhaps interesting to emphasize the difference between the maps for use on land and the maps for use at sea. The periplus, it literally means the sort of sailing around. So you just, for instance, for the map that Arrian made, the author who also described Alexander, he starts, I forget if it's Trebizond or at Byzantium, and then he goes, basically sails east into the Black Sea, and just goes all the way around the coast of the sea till he gets back to the point where he started. Which potentially says a lot about how the ancients preferred to sail the sea instead of, you know, you might go straight, more or less straight north from the coast of Turkey and end up in the Crimea. But instead they go around so they can keep the shore nearby. While the land maps are a network map, is that a good way to put it? I'm not sure if everybody's seen the Partinger map, and here we have a disadvantage of a podcast where we don't have any visual materials, unless Angus can just pop up a picture of the Partinger map right now. But it is a, how would you describe it, Mark?
I think that many of the itinerary style maps, itinerarium, they were kind of like a map of for example, the London Underground or the New York City subway. It wasn't so much that you were trying to create an accurate representation in space of all of these various places, but you were more or less saying, if you want to get from this place, this city, point A, to point B and C and D, you have to first go to city B, city C, city D, and that's your itinerary as you go along, and you know the distances. And I think that one of the reasons for these things is because the routes to various places, the overland route, that is, as the crow flies, as is sometimes said, would be impossible to take. So if you wanted the straight distance, it would be impossible. So you would actually be going from maybe to another city a little out of your way, but it would probably be faster and easier to do it that way.
Yeah, so importantly, direction is not indicated. You have to know what the nearby city is that is the first on your route, and then you go from there, you take it from there, from there, from there.
I'm going to use audiovisual material and talk about the fact that, you know, the very first roadmaps in the 19th century are exactly the same, that they are a single line to tell you how to get from London to Oxford. And they're straight up and down. They're not directional. They're not giving you any side roads. They're going, no, this road. So I think that kind of map actually lasts a lot longer than our expectations of map.
It's exactly what Herodotus is giving in terms of the progress of the Persian army when they're sort of crossing across Asia Minor, that it is one location after another, but it's not, you know, there are some of the obvious trading stops that you might mention later on in terms of the Silk Route and the Persian Royal Road that just do not get a look in, because he is going on a tried and tested known Persian military as such. So it's the downfall of it. It's like in terms of if you go to Caesar and the survey of the British coastline that he has done before his arrival in Britain, their mapping and their surveying of the coastline of Britain comes up with that shortcoming of it. They miss out the details of the deep harbours or whatnot along the coastline. And it's exactly like you mentioned before, the sort of coast exploration of Australia early on, and the fact that, you know, you've got James Cook sailing straight past Sydney Harbour, Port Jackson, because he doesn't actually properly investigate these things as he goes along the coast. It's only later on that the extent of it is realised, and same with the Romans.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing when we, you know, when you get a an ancient history book or a translation like Herodotus, and you see the map, or Alexander's conquests, you see the map and you visualise based on the map of where they went and how far they got. And I think, you know, that idea of being on the ground and marching 4 days, doesn't really matter what direction or where you're going, as long as there's food and water between those spots. And that, so that linear around, you know, marching periplus is far more important. And I think, again, with Caesar in the Gallic War and in the Civil Wars, more in the Gallic War than in the Civil Wars, that idea of I put it in stores here, I put in stores here, I put in stores here, is, again, if you think of it in a mapping sense, where the ration stops are, that, you know, along the way, there's this march to there, this march to there, this march to there, but there's food on the route. So that sort of idea of logistics and a logistical map, and even a retracing of your steps, you know, yes, there might be a straighter line if you sailed directly north, but you can't guarantee that you have a reliable harbour, you can't guarantee that you have water or provisions at that point. So therefore, stick stick to the map and the itinerary, and that will have what you need along this route that we've made for you.
Especially sailing across sea, it would help to have a compass, which they didn't. If you think about it, I suspect that anybody like us who's an enthusiast of military history is probably interested in maps, and we look a lot at maps. But if you think about how, you know, the modern, your car points the road for you, it basically just said, you know, from this crossroads, go right, follow it for this distance, go left. For this distance, go right. It's essentially the same way. It's perfectly possible to go a very complicated route and never actually see a map like we're used to.
And I think the funny thing about that, of course, is that that kind of mapping and our mapping tools today have almost in a way gone right back to the first mapping tools, which essentially ignore geography. You know, the fact that this road goes here doesn't tell you that it's a very steep incline, that, you know, you're actually going through the valley of a river that's the only access point in a break of the hills, that, you know, and a lot of that's local knowledge only. The only way through this is through that pass is not something that would be written on an ancient map. It would be something that either is indicated because that's the road, like, you know, the trip to Delphi, for instance, which, you know, lots and lots of Greeks do. There's one road in. You can't get in there any other way because it's so precipitous and mountainous that actually there's no other options. And I think when you start to think in those terms, the goat track around Thermopylae and those secret routes that aren't secret routes, they're just local routes that only locals know about and they're not on itineraries. That they are kind of these, we see them as secret and we see them as revelations of betrayal rather than, oh no, there's a road that goes that way. It's just not on your map, but you don't have a map. You have an itinerary. So yeah, let me show you. This is how you get there. So I think in those terms, it starts to make a different picture of how the sort of the mindset of the ancients worked.
It also is a very nice bridge to one of the questions, which is how important were local guides in helping armies versus established maps or information? Well, the answer is clearly very, because the maps will help you get from A to B, but not decide what's the best position, where there's a choke point in the mountains that you can exploit, or a route around such a point that you can take to...
And I think that also is our way of thinking of it. It's a very modern way of thinking of it, because the local guides, you know, again, when you think Thermopylae, it's a betrayal as opposed to a local guide, which is a sort of a separate image. Whereas when you think about Kadesh, you know, they used local guides to tell them where they're going, and that idea that they're spies because they don't tell them that the Hittite army's, you know, camped close by. But if you think of it in mapping terms, that sort of consideration doesn't come into the sort of the thinking. You know, and in Spain you've got local guides for, you know, all of the campaigns that they fight in Spain, and probably in Britain as well. Guides is, you know, they're not employed as guides. They might be a tribe or a population that have invited you in, and therefore it's in their interest to have you know where you're going. The other thing I've always thought about the king of Macedonia, who Medizes and yet is known as a Philhellene, he of course ensures that the Persian army gets through Macedonian territory as quickly as possible, and, you know, speeds them on their way for their conquest of Greece. And A, that gets them out of his territory and he doesn't have to feed them. But B, it's also from a geographical perspective, it's like, yeah, no, go there, go straight. You know, that's how you get through my territory. Don't get distracted by that left turn. Just go straight, straight, straight. So I think, yes, they're very important. And they're not necessarily mentioned. You know, I think one of the things we often get, like if you think about the March of the 10,000 after Kunaxa, they must have had guides to tell them how to get out of Persian territory. That can't have just been a blind marching around in the wilderness for however long. They must have used locals, whether voluntary or pressed into service, we don't know. But they, you know, some form of how do we march out of here? Otherwise, they're going to end up in dead end valleys, and they don't, you know, they never make the wrong turn. They're always going somewhere.
It must be. I mean, and the local guides, famously, Napoleon had when pressed into service when he marched up to Waterloo. So that's nothing new. That didn't change for a very long time, in fact. And there's examples even more recent in World War II where, you know, local civilians help units get around the position, whether it's to their advantage or not.
Even more recent, there's the same things happening in Afghanistan, because a satellite image and a drone don't tell you what's on the ground in the Khyber Pass to this day. You know, and they've been fighting over the Khyber Pass since Alexander's time.
They still don't know.
They still don't know. It's like, oh my gosh. And then, of course, beyond geography, you've got, maps don't show you where ideology changes or where, you know, tribal territories, which is a nebulous kind of thing. We love a map that shows us where the Huns came from or where Genghis Khan came from or went to. And you're like, this is a vast open plain with no feature on it. It's a vague area of 100, maybe even more kilometers where maybe there's a border. And yet people on the ground go, no, that's their territory. This is our territory. And you're like, there's nothing, you know, there's no river here to delineate your border. How do you know? And they know. And I suppose, you know, border disputes in Greece are the same. But they had stones to say this is our border, and they shifted.
And hoplites to stand next to them, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose reconnaissance troops, when the army's on campaign, would play a big role in this too. But we do know something about them. Not as much probably as we would like to. For the Romans, of course, we have the Exploratores, and that's been a while that I read that book by Boris Rankov.
Yeah, but I think we actually concentrate more on them when they're not there. You know, at the Battle of Lake Trasimene, when scouts aren't used. I think scouts aren't used at the Battle of Adrianople. You know, it's like, hang on, how did you not know that the Gothic cavalry was on its way back? That's odd. I think that those sorts of troop types were always being used, except when they weren't, and that's when we emphasize that they weren't used. But most of the time, they're not mentioned, and they are used. So I think that, yeah, all of those sorts of things are, because our sources don't explicitly mention using maps or itineraries, we don't necessarily think of generals in hand with itineraries to march next, or, you know, how they made their roads between points which are dead straight, and, you know, plumbati to make sure that the road is straight. And it kind of, you know, like Hadrian's Wall, ignores geography and the imposition of Roman will upon geography, except at really, really bad points where it's like, where we have to deviate here because we can't make this work. And even there, I just did some research on the Rudge Cup, and there's now three plus a couple of fragments that are very similar itineraries. They start on the westward point, and they name the forts of Hadrian's Wall going eastwards from the west. And then every now and then they'll miss one out. And you're like, hang on a minute, how does that work? How can you miss out a fort on Hadrian's Wall? And I think that itinerary idea is a way of making sense of that in your own mind as to why that would.
Maybe in terms of, you've always got these armchair geographers like, you know, the likes of Strabo, who were, Ptolemy and then Strabo. I mean, it's, you're basically saying, well, what exactly are they basing it on? It seems to be a good genre in the ancient world. So, you know, how far does it go? Where are these, you know, the cup, you know, where are the cups being produced and whatnot? Are they being produced locally? Etc. Yeah.
Is it someone who actually knows what they're doing, or is it they making it from miles away? You know, much like some of the myths in Herodotus. But I think it's again that idea that, oh no, they're systematic. Pausanias's, you know, description of Greece is systematic. He's describing everything. And you're like, well, no, there's probably some things that he doesn't describe, just as there are things today that don't exist that he did describe. And in a way, he is very systematic in terms of his travels around Greece, whereas someone like Strabo...
Strabo is systematic, but he's systematic as long as you follow his route and his line of thought. And if it deviates from it, yeah, you could miss out, hit something huge.
I was expecting that when we discussed this topic, we would just straight go on to the tactical and discuss how geography influenced battles. And yet nobody's even tried to get a debate dangling.
Aren't we good and open-minded and you know, looking at big picture stuff? But I think it's amazing how when you start to think about geography and how geography affected battle, you actually start to think in a much wider terms. You know, one of the things that whenever I've spoken to a non-military historian, generally in conversations with my wife, have always been, why is it that groups of men decide to just meet somewhere and fight? I just wouldn't. And you're like, oh, okay. And when you think about, well, they're both working on the same itinerary, they're going to end up here. That's where they're going to meet. You know, there's not actually other routes to meet at. And you're like, oh, okay. Whereas, you know, in Greece, thinking about battle sites and a style of warfare that is so bizarrely unsuited to the geography of Greece, which is precipitous and mountainous and not flat plains, what you get, of course, is the reuse of battlefields. There are multiple battles fought at Thermopylae, which is, of course, a choke point, but there are multiple battles fought at Mantinea, Chaeronea. Well, Boeotia in general is, of course, the dancing floor of war, according to Plutarch, because it has flat plains. And when you start to look, and you look at Tegira, Leuctra, they're very close, Plataea. They're actually not far apart. You're like, well, you were close enough to be fighting the second battle of Plataea when you fight the battle of Leuctra.
But you just wanted some variety.
Like the whole Gaugamela-Arabella debate. Let's call it Arabella because it's a nicer word than Gaugamela. You know, which town do we choose to name the battle after? And that's still to this day. You know, naming battles. Waterloo is the same. It's actually closer to some other towns. You could have easily called it something else rather than...
But Braine-l'Alleud doesn't really work in English.
Well, exactly. Well, yeah, but they would have just changed it, like Wipers. You know, it's like, well, we're not calling it Ypres. No, Wipers, mate, Wipers. So that whole naming convention of battles is such an interesting aspect too, that these, you know, Agincourt, that idea. And so many battles are named after not the closest geographical or topographical feature, but the best suited one. And that, of course, changes on the side. If you look at the American Civil War, you've got the Union name for the battle and the Confederate name for the battle are different because of their different ideas. You know, Manassas, Shiloh, all of these things, Bull Run, which one's which? They're the same battle. Oh, okay. And that must be the same.
Not Shiloh and Bull Run, though.
But that might have nothing to do with the geography at all. It might be to do with, you've got the, you know, think of the Peloponnesian War. We're getting that because it's Thucydides. He's coming from an Athenian perspective and whatnot. So it's the Peloponnesian War for them. But on the other hand, the Spartans, they're looking at the Athenian War. So, yeah. Again, the Romans as well, the Punic Wars. Sorry, you got me started now.
No, it's all good. But the Attic War just sounds like something you do on the roof of your house. But you're right, absolutely. And everything we call it. We get that occasionally today, where we call it World War II, and yet you get the Russian name for World War II is different. The same with
we are drifting a bit here, Murray.
It's all tied together. You know, the War of Northern.
Yeah, Greece, I know. I mean, yeah. Warfare is on somewhere on planet Earth, at least for history. So it's
okay. You want to segue? I'll segue back. The amazing thing about that, and again, we're not talking tactically; we're talking conceptually. That geography defines how we talk about wars. We talk about Persian wars. We talk about Peloponnesian wars. But that's because we've chosen arbitrarily a perspective to take. And there are other perspectives, that, as Mark just pointed out, within the ancient world that name those wars differently. You know, the Battle of Marathon probably wasn't called the Battle of Marathon by the Persians. They probably didn't even like to mention it. Those things would be named different things simply because of geography. Yeah, the Peloponnesians are not going to call it the Peloponnesian War. So that kind of conceptual basis is geographically based as well.
But you were trying to say something, I think, about how people ended up on a field to fight. And, of course, that has something to do with perhaps logistics and making the other guy fight if he doesn't want to. There's some very famous examples of geography playing, as we hinted at before, where the scouts clearly didn't do their job. And you get meeting engagements, or the scouts are doing their job, but they meet the other scouts at the same time, and instead of reporting back, they just get into a fight. Kinescaphaloi comes to mind.
But on the other hand, you get like something like, I'm thinking Antigonus versus Eumenes, in terms of after the Battle of Paratikenae, and you get them separating, and when they start coming back together, and Antigonus, Monophalanthus, comes at him, supposedly, in a more direct fashion across open salt plains. And then it says he and his army observe the campfires that Eumenes basically sets up as, you know, deception, that his army is actually on the ready, already aware of their secret or quiet approach. But there's no mention of scouts there. As such, it's then that he sort of sends, he then diverts his army away from the salt pan, and then gets information from local, you know, local population about what's going on. It just strikes me as a, you know, where are the scouts in that case? I mean, you hear about Macedonian scouts in other armies, but it seems an odd you know, lack of intelligence there.
Yeah. I wonder, just thinking about that, whether one of the aspects of Hannibal's crossing of the Alps is actually the lack of, you know, he must have had local scouts to show him a route across the Alps, but no one had conceived that there were those things before, which is remarkably, not short-sighted, but that idea of there's no geographical ambition. People don't need to cross the Alps, so they don't think about crossing the Alps. You know, and I think those of us that have the wanderlust bug, that idea of, well, what's beyond Yonkers, Barnaby, and that idea that Hannibal can somehow come into Italy via the Alps in a way that no one's ever thought to do it before, that there isn't an itinerary for, there isn't a map for it. Here he shows up, shocking us all that he's turned up in the Italian peninsula, having done this remarkable deed. That idea that sort of exceeds the boundaries of expectation because they've marched a different way. Are you saying with the, you know, where Crassus and Mark Antony go into Persia, they follow Alexander's route, I think. You know, that route that Alexander marches is the established route into the Persian heartland, and that's the route. You don't think outside the square and go, but hang on, there's a better route. You know, you're only one day march away from a better source of water, which we know now with our modern technology. But no, you do what has always been done, and you march this way and you go here. And I think that's, and again, probably something that makes some of the conquests of Britain, for instance, interesting, because, of course, it's unmapped and it's uncharted in that sense, that you're essentially drifting through the countryside, fighting whoever happens to be tribally there, rather than any kind of systematic, well, this is the road, we're going to meet at this battle site and fight.
Well, actually, they've just this week, you've got the news of the finds that are being made up along the west coast in Scotland, that's arguing basically that Agricola's advances through the north, he at least had two, maybe three different routes being taken north. So that argues against, you know, it just being, you know, the tried and tested, but rather, you know, that there is a, you know, a larger planet, you know, that at work as such.
And then that idea, maybe, therefore, that, you know, if we make contact, we have intercepts between us, and our scouts will basically go and tell the other group, well, they're over there, come. So then you amass your forces and fight, which, you know, again, is that idea of guerrilla warfare where you avoid that.
And then you can strike from the sea, because I think we've got one question live by Brian Hartman. Have we talked through amphibious landings in ancient warfare?
That's a great question. And amphibious landings, I don't think that we should keep in mind either D-Day in Normandy or Iwo Jima, right, where, you know, they're going across in that sense. And I think there is an example, I think, from Caesar when he invaded Britain that the Roman soldiers were unwilling to get off their ships, and one of the eagle bearers, the aquilifers of one of the legions, right, he had to jump in and say, you know, hey, I'm going in. You want to protect your eagle, you better follow me. And that got them in.
It's even better for the D-Day idea of that one. The description actually, just before that, Caesar says that a couple of galleys with catapults actually sail out to the flanks of his invasion fleet and start to pelt the Britons on shore with catapult bolts. So it's really like the battleships going...
I think that was a rare example of a contested landing. I think that... amphibious landings. I don't think there were all that many of them in that regard. It's difficult to defend a coastline.
Well, the defended coastline is difficult, but there are more examples. I mean, you know, always the question is, if you're just transporting troops from one landmass to another and you just put them on shore and they go do stuff, is that an amphibious landing or not? There is an amphibious landing in the Civil War between Octavian and Mark Antony on the one hand, and the Liberators on the other, when they put some troops on land in the rear of the Liberators' army. Marathon is really the result of one.
There's one example of... I'll call one example amphibious from 209 BC when Scipio takes his troops in. There's a lagoon outside of New Carthage, and he learns from local fishermen that the lagoon, the water level will go down at a particular time, and he takes his troops in there to attack at a relatively undefended part of the wall. So there's an amphibious landing in that regard. I also noticed there's a question about the use of pontoon bridges, which I would say that this probably meant like bridges of boats, where you, in order to cross a body of water, you're going to throw up a temporary bridge where the boats themselves will support the walkway, the causeway. And that is at least on two occasions. There's the one that I think that Darius uses to cross the Bosporus, which is a bridge of boats. And there's also another one from, I want to say it was 513 BC. It was what Darius used to cross the Danube in Europe when he took his army north to go fight the Scythians. And that bridge was very prominent because the fact that the Ionian Greeks were tasked to hold that bridge for him was what the reason why he was able to actually extricate his army ultimately from his expedition into against the Scythians. So those use of bridges of boats, and so certainly, you know, I don't know if we call them pontoons, but they were certainly used in that same manner.
Yeah, I think in terms of amphibious landings, you've got Mycale as well. Sphacteria probably, you know, they're trying to break the blockade at Sphacteria by just crashing boats into the island.
Could you include Naupactus as well? I know it's not an amphibian landing, but in terms of like all these amphibian landings, you're sort of talking about the geographical knowledge of the coastline coming into play, you know, whether it be Caesar stuffing up his arrival in Britain because he doesn't understand the nature of the beaches and how what depth changes there are, or, you know, whatnot. At Naupactus, you've got, you know, basically corralling the Peloponnesian ships so that they actually end up running out of water in terms of the amount of space that they've got to actually take in their their maneuvers that they want to undertake. So in that sense, it's a knowledge of that local waterway and the depth or the currents, etc., that is coming into play, and that's a crucial factor.
That might even be something at play in Agus Potami, that isn't generally considered. I think also Actium, I remember reading the book on Actium that came out, 81, that the reason for Antony's ability to escape is that he knew that the wind would shift, and he had his sails on the ship. Therefore, when the wind shifted, he can actually sail southwards towards Egypt, which again is that knowledge of wind direction, current, all of that sort of stuff. And again, you don't know that unless you're local. So I think that idea that all of those things play into their understanding, and in many cases we might not understand it, and it takes someone to kind of go, hang on a minute, isn't this what's happening?
You get that beautifully in the First Punic War, where you're getting those, the Carthaginian ships running blockades in the western ports of Sicily, basically running with the wind in order just to, full steam into ports, full steam out of ports. It's the local knowledge coming in because of their familiarity with coastline there.
Local knowledge like that was what made it possible for Hannibal the Rhodian to get in and out of Lilybaeum, which was, at the time, blockaded. Not only was besieged by the Romans on land, but it was blockaded by Roman ships at sea. But he knew a particular geographical secret, where there's, if you kept a particular part of a tower of the of Lilybaeum's fortified wall in view, you could actually make it through particularly deep water to get in and out. And the Romans had to move heaven and earth to actually capture him while he was doing this. But the Carthaginian blockade runners were remarkably successful because of their local knowledge of this city. And also the Siege of Tyre was an amphibious operation in large part. The probably most famous about the Siege of Tyre was that Alexander had first one and then two causeways built out or moles out to the city. But at the same time, he only succeeded in capturing Tyre when he had enough ships to attack it from all sides and bring siege artillery to bear against the walls of Tyre. So, I mean, the word amphibious is one of those things where, because it is typically used so much in a World War II context, whether it's D-Day or the operations against the islands in the Pacific, that it is certainly amphibious in the sense that you were attacking land from the water. So in that regard, I think the Siege of Tyre was an amphibious operation. And what was going on maybe at Lilybaeum too was amphibious in many regards, although not nearly as successful. The Lilybaeum remained in Carthaginian hands until the end of the First Punic War, never actually fell.
So what Mark is trying to say is that you should never try to picture any ancient amphibious landing as Ridley Scott's, Robin Hood movie.
Well, if what you have in mind of an amphibious invasion is Saving Private Ryan, there would have been some aspects where someone coming from the shore is under fire from someone on land. But generally speaking, in the ancient world, I think that it was very hard to defend a coastline consistently. I mean, one of the things that you learn again and again from ancient military history is that navies were generally very poor at defending the coastline, and people on land generally had difficulty stopping an enemy fleet from coming ashore and depositing their troops. It was just a difficult thing to do. It was not impossible, but it was a difficult thing to do.
Unless you were Archimedes.
What? But he ended up being stabbed because he was trying to work out a problem.
Yeah, but that was because of a land-based assault. It wasn't because of a amphibious landing that he defended against. So,
but I've seen the MythBusters episode, which doubts everything he did. But the other thing I think that's interesting about Tyre, and I was thinking about Galgamalia as well in terms of geography, what you have in those situations is not only amphibious, but also, not Galgamalia, is man imposing geography on the battlefield. So in Galgamela, of course, they flatten the terrain in the middle so that the chariots can operate effectively, and they don't because Alexander comes up with defences. But at Tyre, he's imposing his own geography. And I think also at Syracuse, where you've got the building of these circumvallations and things like that, Dyrrachium for Caesar and Pompey, that idea of the imposition of human will on the geography of the battlefield is a different kind of mindset in a way. Mostly battles adhere to the contours of the battlefield and the topography and the geography. You know, we've talked about the choke points, Thermopylae. You're going to end up defending Thermopylae because it's easy to defend. You're going to end up having to attack Thermopylae because it's easy to defend. There's lots of battlefields where they are the natural meeting point of two armies. The Trasimene is the natural route that Hannibal would take. So therefore that defense of that. There are lots of battles at river crossings. And again, when you think about amphibious in that regard and pontoon bridges, there are only several places where a river can be crossed. You can't just cross a river wherever you want, unless you're Caesar and build a bridge, in which case it's going to be obvious because it's going to be, they're building a bridge over there. But, you know, if you think about the Hydaspes, if you think about the Granicus even, it's like, well, it has to be at A, B, or C, because those are your three crossing points. So the battle has to occur at one of them. And if you think about the Battle of the Trebia, so many battles that happen at river crossings. And I wonder what you were saying, Mark, about the inability of ancient armies to resist a landing. The other fact of that, of course, is that, yeah, but it's not a decisive encounter. If I repulse your landing, I haven't beaten your army.
Well, an ancient, if you kick an ancient fleet, if you stop it from landing, they might run into logistics problems pretty quickly because they generally can't just turn around and just go back to where they came from. Mm.
But there's almost that sort of unspoken agreement that we'll let you land and then we'll beat you.
Oh no, there's a very effective, when you've got Perdiccas taking his army down to take on Ptolemy's Egypt, and of course he tries to make it a two-prong attack and bring in his fleet to support his land base and take his land base down via the Fort of Camels. The Ptolemy's forces mount a very good defence against the fleet, forcing the fleet to turn around and play no part in it. And I think it has a huge effect. And then you have the exact same thing happen later on when Antigonus tries to do the same thing. And again, he is trying to take his fleet to support his land forces. And because the fleet, again, makes no impact into the Nile Delta, it basically means that his land forces are, up against an impossible task because they haven't got that support.
Is that successful defence also local knowledge? You've got, residents of the Nile Delta defending their delta against invading armies that don't actually know what they're doing or where they're coming.
And you've got the captains of those fleets who are not working with local knowledge going up the mouths of the delta. So they're sort of, again, a little bit, I wouldn't say needle in a haystack, but they are feeling around for what they're hoping to find, basically, there.
Well, again, I think, Xerxes' invasion, it's like, well, you lost half your fleet because you didn't know the local conditions and you were going to get your fleet destroyed by storms, which all of the Greek fleet knew about. So, I think allowing Salamis too, that there's the use of geography to restrict a battlefield to make sure that you can, use your own smaller fleet to your advantage and the enemy's larger fleet can't operate. I think those sorts of things are probably more common than we realize.
Geography was extremely important to virtually all naval battles. Almost all naval battles occurred within sight of land, very close to the coast. And that was due to several factors that had to do with the nature of ancient fleets. Ancient galleys, they carried a lot of men compared to the actual size of the ship itself, which meant that they did not have much room for food or water, which itself was relatively heavy. So you would have had to constantly bring your fleet onto shore for a number of reasons. Each ship would have to have their men take their meals, whether it's lunch, or dinner ashore. You'd have to allow the men time to stretch their legs, just get out of their ship because they're crammed into a small galley for hours on end. And they would also have to find food ashore. And one of the things that is constantly seen in Thucydides is that the Greeks are often asking local people to set up a market where their rowers can go and get food because they don't actually have food on the ships for them. Another thing is that war galleys had difficulty sailing against adverse winds, which meant that since you can't make any headway if the winds are too heavy, you have to put yourself ashore and wait it out until the winds change. And finally, because of the fact that just about all of these fleets are moving along the coastline, they will typically run into each other on the coastline in time for battle, or at the time of battle, which is why they're always inside of land. It wasn't that the ancients couldn't do a straight shot across a large body of water. So, for example, if you were sailing to Crete, or you're going from Tunisia to Sicily, or from Sicily to Tunisia, or maybe from Africa to Spain, you would have sailed over water for a few days at a time.
But in those cases, you're always within sight of land. If you're sailing from Tunisia to Sicily, you will be able to see the coastline of Sicily.
One of the things is that you're crossing open water, I think is what I meant to say. You're crossing open water. So what one of the things about these you would have done that, but for the most part, fleets prefer to travel along the coastline for the reasons that I mentioned earlier. And we see that because all of these battles are taking place in the coast line itself, the shore, becomes a factor in many of these battles. For example, at the Battle of Ecnomus in 256 BC, the Romans and Carthaginians are fighting, and one of the Roman squadrons is actually trapped up against the shore by the Carthaginian left wing and is only saved when the victorious Roman squadrons elsewhere come to its aid. Once you're trapped against the shore and you have no means of escape as galley, typically what would happen is that the rowers would abandon their ships and then flee inland. That happened also several times in the Peloponnesian War. Another example of the coast becoming a hindrance to one of the fleets was at the Battle of Drepana in 249 BC, in which Publius Claudius Pulcher, the new Roman commander, consul for that year, takes the Roman fleet on a daring nighttime mission against Drepana, which is one of the Carthaginians' fortified ports in Sicily during the First Punic War. And he times it so that he's appearing right outside of Drepana at sunrise, and he achieves complete surprise. It seems, however, that he's at the back of his fleet. Maybe he's in the rear to keep all the stragglers going forward because they're in the dark. But what happens is that means that the lead elements of the Roman fleet are going into the Drepana port before Pulcher even shows up. And he is delayed also. The legendary story goes is that the sacred chickens that the Romans would always take to with them to judge pre-battle omens, they didn't want to eat their food, and that was a bad omen for the coming battle. So Pulcher says, well, if the chickens won't eat, let them drink. And he takes the chickens and throws them overboard, and it's a sacrilege. Whether the story is true or not, who knows? There's probably an ex post facto justification for why the Romans, what happens next. So what happens is that the Romans are coming into this port of Drepana, but the Carthaginians have seen them coming. So, but even though they're surprised, the Carthaginian admiral is named Adherbal, and he manages to get his entire fleet, everybody, immediately onto their ships, and they're rowing out. So what happens is that as the Romans are going into the port, entering from the south, the Carthaginians have already put to sea and are heading out westward. So finally, when Pulcher arrives and is able to get his ships in a semblance of order, not only are the Carthaginians standing out to sea, but Pulcher chooses to place himself with the land at his back right? Because they suggest that maybe he was looking at it from a perspective of he'd at least be able to retreat onto land if the battle went against him. And it did because, in large part, the Romans had no room to maneuver. That is, the Carthaginians, with the sea at their back, could charge in a ram and then retreat. All right, they had the advantage of mobility, whereas the Romans, they had nothing behind them to retreat to. They would ground themselves. So after being mauled, Pulcher, who had brought at least, I think, 123 ships with him to Drepana, he leaves, I think he leaves only about 30 ships. So he loses dozens, almost his entire fleet. And it's a gigantic victory for the Carthaginians, mainly because the role of geography, that is, the shoreline was there. There was nowhere to retreat to, and the Romans just could not. They basically trapped themselves. Yep.
I think when you start to think, you know, big picture, geography is always at play. You know, if you think about kind of Scyphali or Pydna, you know, geography ends empires in that regard. And I think that's something that when we think about ancient warfare, it's not something we concentrate on. But you could easily do an account of every battle we've ever talked about in regard to geography, you know, and how did the armies end up where they ended up? Geography. Why did they fight the way they fought? Geography. You know, and I think, again, that's one of the unanswered questions about the development of hoplite warfare, whether it's a revolution or whether it's a long development over time in a system of terrain that doesn't suit it. You know, of all the Greek city-states or the Greek populations, the cavalry-based ones tend to do a warfare that suits their terrain. Even the Macedonians, it's like, well, their mountainous terrain doesn't suit this massive phalanx of pikemen, and yet that's what you develop. Crete, you know, when you read about Crete in Plato's Laws, the whole reason that the Cretans develop into archers and nimble runners is because of the terrain of Crete. That's what their terrain suits. And you're like, oh, well, hang on a minute, but that's not what the rest of Greece does. Why is that? And it's interesting because it plays against what you would expect of the terrain. Whereas, you know, massed heavy infantry chariots in, you know, flat desert terrain of the Persian Empire and places like that makes much more sense. Cavalry on the terrain, you know, on the steps of the Hunnic steps, that makes sense.
I believe that the explanation for the Samnites' relatively flexible, open order style of warfare was because central Italy, south central Italy, was hilly terrain, and they couldn't just line themselves up in one, you know, big Greek style phalanx and fight effectively. And in fact, the Romans, it is suggested, adopted their relatively flexible, open order legion from the Samnites, that style of warfare. So certainly, I think that terrain matters a lot. And if you are relatively people living in a relatively circumscribed area, for example, such as the Samnites, attuning your style of combat to the ground that you're going to be fighting over makes a lot of sense. And it turns out that the Roman legion was so flexible that it could be adapted to fighting in an open plain or in much more much hilly or more close terrain.
I think we can keep talking about this forever, but that might turn into a very long podcast. But let's try and close with one final question that's been posted on the public comments. SNPI asks, were key passes not completely fortified to protect empire, for example, the Dariel Pass?
No. I think there are attempts to fortify passes, but they're always garrisoned, and those garrisons tend not to stick around. Again, you know, Thermopylae, there's 1,000 Phocians defending it, and they don't defend it. You know, even when you have the barbarian invasions, you've got Elymais with a fort system, again, that gets breached. And I wonder if a lot of the ancient warfare, like with the amphibious landings we were talking about, is reactionary you know, we will react to something happen rather than try and prevent it from happening in the first place. I think, you know, the defense of passes and the defense of pre-made positions is a very tricky thing in ancient warfare terms.
Also, you have to be lucky enough that the pass is just happens to be the border of your country that you want to defend. And of course, for the Roman Empire, by the later stages, the later eras, it's, you know, the Alpine passes. Some of the Alpine passes are important, and they do get reinforced. But yeah, you're right. If you don't maintain the fortress and you don't keep a garrison there.
And if you're, then, you know, the Cilician gates. It's like, well, Alexander could have been stopped in his tracks there very easily. But it's in the middle of Cilicia. Why would you fortify a pass that's in the middle of your territory? And it might not have originally. It would make the perfect border. But at some point, someone's conquered both sides of it and gone, well, this is all now one place. You know, the Amanus gates, these gates, the Syrian gates, so many gates that would be perfectly blockable, but that when you get a giant empire, the only ones that make sense to defend are on the borders.
It's also a matter of the local tribes in these areas, looking at, you know, what is their interest. Do they, you know, they've got to make a decision of, do they make these passes available to armies like Alexander the Great coming through? Or do you, you know, there's the area of Cappadocia that, you know, traditionally you've got the tribes through there asking for payment to go through. And the other example is the through the mountains on the way to Spain, that you've got references by the Romans constantly, Sertorius, you know, famously saying that he values time rather than time is more valuable than his money, so he's happy to part with his money. You know, these tribes are sort of making a quick buck, but at the same time, judging, you know, how far can you push an army, you know, etc. So there's more to it than just simply saying, you know, why can't somebody shove some troops there?
But also, and I think again, it comes full circle, because that's how I roll. Get it? Full circle? No, okay, fine. And when you come back to these itineraries that we have, yeah, it took you some time. No, it's early for me. It's, I'm just getting warmed up. When you think about the Battle of Issus, for instance, where Darius is able to get behind Alexander, and that idea of the itinerary map, which we began our discussion with, Alexander's walking down the coast, and there's another route that he isn't told about, doesn't know about, hasn't defended, hasn't sent men to find out. You know, he knows that Darius is somewhere near. He wants a battle with Darius. Darius gets behind his route of march, so he has to turn around and come back and fight the Battle of Issus. Those sorts of things are probably a combination of all the things we've talked about. Local knowledge, oh, of course there's another route. We just go this way. And all of that's an amazing defining factor in how ancient warfare is fought.
I think we'll keep it to that. We might come back to it someday, or maybe more than once. But I think tonight I'm going to thank the people who have been watching. I hope you enjoyed the show, and everybody else will hear you very soon.